We come this morning to verse 32 of Hebrews chapter 11, which in one sense, there's room up here if you want to take a seat. In one sense, kind of is the culmination of this chapter. You know Hebrews 11, you've all read it, I'm sure, many times, and you know how it just goes example by example through all these Old Testament saints and just shows their faith in God and how their faith lasted until the end, until death, and just the amazing acts that they did by means of faith. They trusted in God amidst all kinds of persecution and trials and whatever it would be. And we talked about how, really when it comes down to it, what faith does is it's our spiritual sight that allows us to comprehend and understand spiritual realities that we can't see. And so, by means of faith, you know, these spiritual realities, we can't see them, but they become real for us. And so, not just for us, but we comprehend their reality, if you will. And so, any decision that you make, you know, you're deciding, well, you know, you're Noah. And you're trying to decide, okay, should I spend the next 120 years of my life building this boat on dry land when there's never been any rain and there's no water anywhere near? You know, and you have this scale and you're weighing it. Well, if you, by means of faith, put all the realities that you can't see on the scale, God is always going to win. And so you see example after example of how people did what from a merely human standpoint would be ridiculous for the sake of God. Whether it's Noah, whether it's Abraham about to sacrifice his only son. Right? That's ridiculous from a purely human standpoint. But if you put God on the scale, by means of faith, you see his reality. All of a sudden, the scales are always tipped in favor of obedience of God. And so we saw so example after example after example of these men and women who trusted in God, who lived for him, and who lived, as we've seen throughout this section, in light of the future. And there's been a huge emphasis in this chapter on the future, the promise, the blessing, the city which is to come. We could use different terminology, but it's all about the promises that God has given, the blessings that God says are sure, and basically, to put it in a word, living in light of eternity. All these men and women lived in light of eternity, and that's what tipped the scales. They said, no matter what goes on here and now, eternity is worth it. Heaven is worth it. Being with God forever is worth it. And we'll see that emphasis as we come to the end of this section once again this morning. So this chapter, it has been incredibly encouraging just personally to my own heart to see so many men and women, example after example after example. And as he gets to the section here in verse 32, it's kind of cool what he does because he's been giving these specific examples and somewhat extended, but he just feels like, you know what, I can't go on with all these examples. There's too many. And so in a sense, the pace of this narrative, or I don't know, wouldn't you call it narrative, but this section of scripture here, it just like increases. All of a sudden, he just puts it on like hyper speed as he starts going. He just starts naming people after people, incident after incident, just in rapid fire, one after the other, just to kind of trigger our minds and cause us to think back to all these old. And really the point of, at least as we start off this section, is, wow. I mean, you go back to the Old Testament. How many examples are there of God's faithfulness? You know, how many people were there who trusted in God amidst, you know, all kinds of odds? And, you know, he's just going to mention a few. It's just like, it's kind of almost an encouragement. Just read through your Old Testament. Just read through it. Did God ever fail those who trusted in him? Did he ever fail them? And of course, the answer is no. And that's what I love about this section is just, it's not so much focusing on one example, but it's just like almost, it's encouraging you just to run in your mind through the Old Testament examples and just think to yourself, ask yourself the question, did God ever fail? Was God always worth it for all these people? And time after time after time again, the answer comes back, yes. Yes, he was worth it. Yes, he was worth it. It's worth it to trust in him. And so we'll see that, and we'll walk through this section. Let me just go ahead and read it for us, starting in Hebrews 11 and verse 32. And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. And others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. Men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. All of these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive the promise, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. Awesome section. And I hope you get a sense of the feel of just the intensity of this section, especially as you know, go through the rest of the chapter. And it's like, by faith, Abraham, and we talk about Abraham. By faith, Noah, talk about, by faith, Moses, you know, and you talk about them. And then all of a sudden here, it's just bam, bam, bam. And, you know, I could, if we were going to do like a topical message on each one of these characters, you know, I could be in this section here for a month, because it's like David. You know, we could go back and look at David's life. We could go back and look at Gideon's life and see so many examples of faith. I'm not going to do that too much, but let me just remind you a little bit. Gideon, you know Gideon, right? The story of how he had, how many men did he have? 32,000, you know, soldiers, and God kept whittling it down to 300. That's pretty stupid from a world's point of view, right? I mean, you have an army of 32,000, you're like, no, that's too many. I need less, right? It's just like, it doesn't make any sense. The only way that you would do that is how? It's by faith, right? It's if you trust in God. Who's going to fight your battle for you? And so Gideon lived by faith. And you know he won the battle with the 300 people. And the, it's like Pastor Roy says, Joshua didn't fight the battle of Jericho. They walked in a circle, right? And God made the walls fall down. We've seen that already. And so Gideon, who's next? Barak. Barak, fought against Sisera. Sisera had these 900 iron chariots, and you know, he fought against the odds because he trusted in God, and he won, you know, and he won the battle. Samson. Now, that's an interesting one for you. Throw Samson into the midst of that. That guy's life was filled with debauchery. I mean, I tend to think that really the reason he gets included in here is for the very end of his life. You know how his life ended, right? He had lived, in one sense, a wicked life. I mean, there's some aspects where he trusted in God, but, I mean, you read the gory details, it's off with prostitutes here and there and all this stuff. And, you know, it's not the exemplary man of faith that we would think to. But the issue with Samson is he came to the end of his life and he trusted in God. And he said, God, and, you know, if you will give me my strength back, I will push these pillars down. You know, and God blessed him and gave him his strength, and you know, he killed more people in his death than in his life. It was an act of faith. He trusted in God, and God vindicated him at the end. And it's a great point, because you look through these men of faith, whether it be David with Bathsheba, whether it be Samson, whether it be Rahab the harlot, whether it be, you go through these, you know, examples, it brings out a good point. These people were not pleasing to God because they were perfect. It's a great point. That's not why they were pleasing to God. Why were they pleasing to God? It's because of faith. It's because they trusted in him. And yes, David, right? He committed adultery. You know, they fell down at times. They failed at times. But as we're going to see, and I think Doug is actually going to preach on this possibly in a couple weeks, it goes to this race metaphor. It's all about the race. It's about keeping the eye on the prize. When you fall down, what do? You get up and you keep running. And so you see that every one of these people pleased God. It's because of their faith. It wasn't because they were perfect, but it's because they trusted in God. And we talked about in the past how that's what pleases God. These people, they went through all these ridiculous things, and what they really show by choosing God over their son, by choosing God over persecution, by choosing God over security, or whatever they chose God over, what they show is God is worth it. It doesn't matter what you put on this side of the scale. You could put whatever it is, torture, we'll read about, being sawn into, It doesn't matter what you put over here. God is worth it. And it pleases God when we live a life that says, God, you are worth it. And we trust in him no matter what. And so it's a great, great reminder to us. Samson, Jephthah, same thing. I mean, that rash vow, he sacrificed his daughter. Anyway, you could go back and read the story. But he trusted in God and won great victories. David, right? David and Goliath. You know that you don't go fight a mighty warrior as a little boy with some stones in a sling, right? But he says, you know you love the great statement. You come at me with, what does he say, swords and, I don't remember, spear, but I come to you in the name of the Lord. That's probably a rough quote. But, he trusted in God, right? And God vindicated him and worked power. He trusted in God when Saul, who's trying to kill his life, right? David stands in front of Saul, and what happens? He doesn't kill him. Because he trusts, he's not going to touch the one the Lord's anointed. You see David's faith, and God vindicated him. God acted in a powerful way. Samuel, the prophets, you just go through your mind. Isaiah, Jeremiah, these men and women, who trusted in God amidst persecution, amidst all kinds of things. And it just floods your mind with all the occurrences and the memories of what these people did. And then in verse 33, he starts going through and just detailing all that they did. By faith, they conquered kingdoms, right? They foreign armies. You read through Israel's history, how they conquered foreign armies. And it's by faith, just trusting in God. Performed acts of righteousness. I would almost say there, I'd probably translate that enacted justice. Speaking more of the judges, how it's not that they themselves did something that was righteous, but it's more emphasizing that they enacted justice just in the way that they, speaking specifically about the kings and, the judges specifically, I think it's probably referencing there, who obtained promises. That God gave them promises and they trusted in them and God vindicated. They trusted in God and God did not show himself faithless. He showed himself faithful, that he did what he promised. He vindicated those who trusted in him despite whatever odds that they went against. They shut the mouths of lions. They quenched the power of the fire. I think shutting the mouths of lions, probably reference to Daniel, right? Quenched the power of the fire, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Man, I've taught through Daniel. Those men's amazing faith, their amazing trust in God. Just let it flood into your mind and remind you of all these great stories. Escape the edge of the sword. From weakness were made strong. Became mighty in war. Put foreign armies to flight. Just over and over, right? Women receive back their dead by resurrection. Speaking probably of the two women that Elisha and Elijah, the Shunammite woman. You remember the story, right? Where he raised her son from the dead. Two different examples, one of Elisha, one of Elijah. Just by faith, all the amazing things that God did. But, and this is what's so encouraging in one sense to me about this passage. Because everyone, you go through that list, everyone that's just been listed, they all have something in common in contrast to where this list is going to go starting next. There's a kind of a break in this list. This list is brought into two parts. And the encouraging thing is, with this first part of the list, every one of these people were people that were vindicated here on earth. They're people where God acted powerfully here on earth, where you throw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into this flaming furnace where the guards that even tried to throw them in got consumed by the flames, and what? Not a hair of their head was singed. They didn't even smell like smoke, the Hebrew says, right? Powerfully vindicated. Right? Lions didn't kill Daniel. Just over and over, you look at these, and so much the message is, God is powerful, God is able, God is faithful, he will keep his word, and he's able to vindicate, here and now. He's that kind of a God. But all of a sudden, you turn to this list, and it says, and others, but others, other people than this. And he's going to start to list a different kind of group of people. And these are people that were not vindicated here on this earth. These are people that died. These are people that were tortured for the name of Christ, for God's sake. These are people who never experienced, if you could say, God's blessing in the here and now. But do you know what? The incredible part is both of these groups of people, as we get to the end, this is so much the message. Both of these groups of people were not motivated by the here and now. They're motivated by eternity. And so much the message of this chapter is, are you willing to die in faith? No matter what the results, will you trust in God? God is able to vindicate. And as we look at the history, you know, at human history, of Old Testament history, you see how God is trustworthy in history. He did vindicate people in time and space. He did show himself powerful in parting the Red Sea and allowing the Israelites to go through it, and in saving Noah with an ark. And you can see all these powerful ways in which he kept his promise in the here and now. And in a sense, his keeping of the promise in the here and now is what encourages us that he will keep it in the future. But you look at all these people, and they were all looking to the future. We'll see that as the author closes out this section. You look at both of these groups of people. Yes, God can vindicate you here. And you see such clear examples of how he did in the past, which gives us encouragement that God will keep his promises. Right? He kept the promises in the here and now that he promised to these people. But we can't see eternity. And you didn't, in one sense, you haven't seen any of these people enter into glory. But his keeping of his promise in the here and the now is what encourages that he will in eternity. We'll see that here. But all of them lived with their eye on eternity. They all lived in light of the promise. We'll see that. We'll get there in just a second. Let's read about the others, if you will. And others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. Interesting contrast here, right? It just said that women received back their dead by resurrection. What kind of resurrection were those? Well, it is a resurrection indeed, but those children of those widows that got resurrected lived for a while, and then they died again, right? But these people lived in light of a better resurrection. They were looking for the final resurrection, the ultimate resurrection, the resurrection that we too look to. And that's going to be the emphasis in this section. Are we looking to the final reward, the final promise, which is being with God forever? As the very last word of this chapter ends, so that they would be made perfect. We'll see when we get there. I think that being made perfect is the resurrection. It's being with God. It's that final promise that we're ultimately looking to, and live all of our life in light of that. It really is what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, that if it's not for the resurrection of the dead, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Right? If it's not for the resurrection, we're a bunch of fools. But because of the resurrection of the dead, that's what all these men and women lived in light of. And so we see what they did by their amazing faith, ultimately in that final promise of being with God forever. Notice as we walk through here, they were tortured. And I love the way even it says this in the Greek, not accepting their release. Literally, they were not even welcoming it. You know, they weren't looking forward to being released from being tortured. And the reason is, well, it's like Pastor says, if you value anything too much, you'll compromise to get it. If you value not being tortured too much, you will compromise. And so these people weren't even, if you will, they weren't welcoming their release. They weren't looking forward to it too much, right? They weren't putting their hope, if you will, in being released from torture. Their hope was in God. Because if their hope was in being released from torture, you know that they'll give up anything to get out of that torture. But once again, what their hope was in, what they were looking forward to, what they were welcoming was God's coming. And so that they held fast to Christ, it's a little bit anachronistic, they held fast to God because they were looking forward to a better resurrection. They're looking forward to, it's not worth it to forsake Christ for anything that this life has to offer. Great statement, right? They would experience mockings and scourgings and chains and imprisonment. You just go through Jeremiah, right? Put in stocks. You just go through the Old Testament. You go through so many examples. And once again, I think this is probably what would have brought encouragement home to these readers, because this is what they were facing. This is what they had gone through in the past, is being thrown in prison for the name of Christ, and that's what they're facing now. So this writer, he writes to encourage them and say, it's worth it. It's worth it to hold fast to Christ. Don't forsake him. Don't get rid of him. And so as he reminds them of those in the Old Testament who had gone through this, these same situations that they're being tested with, they would have brought it home to them. And you're going to see how he does that as he continues on in this section. They were stoned, sawn in two, tempted, put to death with the sword. Right? You know all that they went through. And even that statement, they were put to death with the sword, it's an amazing statement because earlier it just said others escaped from the sword. Once again, there's a contrast. That God may vindicate you. You may escape from the sword powerfully, but others may not. But the question is, you still live by faith either way because your hope is of a better resurrection. They went about, they showed that they were aliens and strangers here, right? They went about in sheepskins and goatskins. It's the, kind of the typical prophetic garb. You know Elijah and Elisha. They went around John the Baptist, lived in the desert, right? They had no abiding home here. They knew that their home was in heaven. They knew that it was to come. And so I love the statement in verse 38, men of whom the world was not worthy. What a great statement, right? These men, the world did not value. But in reality, God valued them, right? In reality, the world may have persecuted them and tortured them and rejected them and cast them out as outcasts. But in reality, the world was not worthy of them. The world said to them that they're not worthy, but God says, no, the world is not worthy of you. And so really, ultimately, as throughout this section, what's important is what does God value? And ultimately, we see here, we'll see again, that God values faith. God values faith. Great statement. Wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. All right, so we get to the conclusion here, and this is, in a sense, verse 39 and 40 is where the whole chapter gets tied together and the meat of it really comes to bear. Let us just spend some time here meditating on the great truths of these two verses. And all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive the promise. Amazing statement. All these, right? He's referencing every single person that has come before, I think. And he says, all of these, having gained approval through their faith, we'll come back to that, did not receive the promise. Interesting once again, because what did he just say in verse, where is it? 33, right? They obtained promises. How can he say in verse 33 that they obtained promises, but here in verse 39, none of them, not a single one of them, received the promise? See the contrast here? I think I'm well justified in saying here that the promise here is singular, it's with the article. The promise here is the ultimate promise. And the ultimate promise is being with God forever. We'll see that clarified in verse 40. It's being with God. It's the resurrection. You could use a lot of different kind of broad summary terms to bring it to bear. It's being made perfect, if you will, in verse 40. Yes, the earlier in Hebrew, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself. But that's what the promise is. Yes, you may receive promises here and now. God has promised us a lot of things. He has promised that he will provide for us, right? And so many of us have seen that provision, right? Have we not? We've experienced that. But none of them received the promise. They were looking forward to that final promise of being, and that of being with God forever. And that's what they had their faith set on. It's living that eschatological mindset in light of eternity that transforms the way we live in the here and now, to where we will do ridiculous things because we put God on the scale, and eternity always outvalues the now. And so every single one of these people did not receive it. They lived in light of eternity, and that's what so much of this is about. He's going to get to chapter 12, he's going to go to the race analogy. They died in faith. That's the message of this chapter, is the faith that is real is the faith that endures to the end. You're not going to finish the race unless you keep your eyes on the goal and keep running that way until you die. And that's the message of this, is about endurance. It's the need to keep on believing, keep on trusting God to the end. And so that's why he keeps bringing it back to the fact that they did not receive the promise. It was set out in front of them. And they kept running towards it till they died, and then they finally reached the goal. Right? It's a great, great truth. But notice this, having gained approval through their faith. That kind of brings this chapter to a close, because at the very beginning of this chapter, several times it's the same word having test, it's the word for testify or witness. And as you get to verse chapter 12 and verse 1, therefore we have so great a cloud of witnesses, same word. It's the noun there and the verb here. But the author brings this whole chapter, because three or four times in the first few verses of this chapter, he mentions that word, he ends it here, and then he transitions into chapter 12. And the message is this: God has testified about these people that they are pleasing to him. God, you ask the question, well, how do I know what pleases God? God has put his seal, he has testified, he has witnessed that faith is what's pleasing to him. They gained approval before God. God has testified, this is it, what is pleasing to me. And so ultimately that's what we want, right? Is to please God. And so how do we know what pleases God? Well, God has made very, very clear that what pleases him is faith. And so they gained approval. God testified about them. They have been testified about, if you will, by God, that their faith was pleasing to him. And so therefore, you get to chapter 12, we have this great cloud of witnesses, this group of people that lived the life of faith, that God testified that they were pleasing to him. And therefore, we are encouraged that that's what's pleasing to God for us as well. And we are encouraged to run the same race that they were called to run. It's a great, great encouragement to us. But they did not receive the promise. Why? And this is awesome. Because God had, and better yet than provided, I would translate had foreseen. It really is literally foreseen. He had foreseen something better for us. In order, or I would probably do that, apart from us, they would not be made perfect. Why didn't they receive the promise? Why didn't they? Because God had a plan. God could have perfected them then. He could have brought in the messianic kingdom. He could have, you know, Jesus could have come. They all entered into the kingdom. But God foresaw something better with us in mind. And this is what's so encouraging and so awesome. God had this plan that included us in this glorious plan that, no, they're not going to enter into the perfection apart from us. No, God's glorious plan is that everybody, Old Testament and New Testament saints alike, all enter into this perfection, if you will, together. And so that's why it becomes so clear in my mind that this is eternity. This is the kingdom. This is future with God. Even the phrase here, having been perfected, it really speaks to the fact, I mean, throughout this book we've seen that there's a sense in which we already have been perfected. We are, and really what the term refers to is that we can enter into the presence of God perfectly holy and righteous because of what Christ has done on our behalf. He used the term in chapter 10, I believe it is, speaking of the fact that we could enter with boldness into God's presence. We could come into the very presence of God, but figuratively, right, by prayer, because we have been perfected. Right? Does that make sense? I don't have time to go into that too much, but because of Christ's work on the cross, our sin has been dealt with, we've been made perfect, and therefore we can enter into God's throne room. That's the way that this term has been used in the past in this book. But here, same basic meaning, but now we're going to actually enter into his presence physically, right? So that I think the perfection here is the ultimate perfection that comes when we're able to be in the presence of God. And this word has a, if you will, a cultic sense to it, in the sense that it really has to do with the sacrificial system and being able to, the high priest, enter into the Holy of Holies. And so, yes, we can enter into the Holy of Holies now by means of prayer because of Christ's once-for-all act, but then we'll be able to enter into the presence of God in a way even more so. And so I think that's really the import of this word, is that we all are going to be perfected together, right? We're all, to use other terminology, we're all going to get resurrection bodies together. We're going to enter into the presence of God together, Old Testament saint, New Testament saint alike. As Christ comes again, he brings in his kingdom. God didn't bring it in then because he wanted us all to enter into this together. And he had a plan concerning us so that, you know, without, you know, apart from us, they would not be made perfect. It's a double negative emphasizing we will certainly all together enter into this perfection. It's a glorious truth. And so you bring this whole chapter to a close. And the question is, what do you have Where's your faith? Where do you have your eyes fixed? Do you have your eyes fixed on eternity? Do you have your eyes fixed on the promise, if you will, that promise of being perfected together with all the Old Testament saints together? And are we living in light of that promise here and now? Right? As we get into chapter 12, it's a race. And if we don't have our eyes fixed on that goal, on the singular promise, the hope that all of in which all of us have been saved, right? Even, I mean, you could go through and just run through your mind through other New Testament passages. I don't need to cross-reference to them all. But you just know that, I mean, 1 Corinthians, as we said, Romans, that's the hope in which we are saved, is the resurrection of the body. Without that hope, our faith is futile. And so we live in light of that hope. We live in light of that promise. We live in light of eternity, no matter what comes our way. And so it doesn't matter what comes. Are you tempted to this? Are you tempted to that? Are you tempted to security or happiness? Anything you put on the scale above God, God will always win because you're living in light of eternity and because he's always worth it. And we've seen example after example after example of men and women in the Old Testament who lived this way, who lived lives of faith, who triumphed. Some were vindicated here on earth, but others weren't. But every single one of them lived this life of faith and showed that it is worth it. And so it's an amazing chapter, amazing book, a great, great reminder to us to live with our focus on heaven. And it's glorious. It's going to be glorious. And it's a great, great encouragement to us to run the race as we've been called to run it. All right? Let me close us in prayer. Our Father, as we do meditate on this great chapter, we thank you for all the witnesses to the life of faith who have lived, who have gone before and stand before and testify that it is worth it. We know that it is worth it to trust in you. You have shown yourself faithful so many times in history where you've vindicated and acted powerfully and showed yourself to be an awesome God. But others, Lord, we recognize were tortured and died and were killed and were destitute and were persecuted and mocked and scorned and rejected by the world. But we know that ultimately they were pleasing to you, and that's all that matters. And so I pray, O Lord, that you would, in each one of our hearts this morning, that you would increase our faith, that you would cause us to trust in you no matter what, that every single decision that we make, when we put on the scale what we should do, that you will always win, that eternity will always be in the forefront of our minds, and that we will live this life of faith until we die. We praise you and we thank you in Christ's name. Amen.